Okay, so friends, this morning our text comes to us from the lectionary text this week. It's from the Gospel of Luke. You don't project it, so I'm just going to read it to you. This is Jesus. He's talking to his disciples. He says, "But to you who are listening, I say, love your enemies. Do good to those who hate you. Bless those who curse you. Pray for those who mistreat you. If someone slaps you on one cheek, turn to them the other also. If someone takes your coat, do not withhold your shirt from them. Give to everyone who asks you. And if anyone takes what belongs to you, do not demand it back. Do to others as you would have them do to you. If you love those who love you, what credit is that to you? Even sinners love those who love them. And if you do good to those who are good to you, what credit is that to you? Even sinners do that. And if you lend to those from whom you expect repayment, what credit is that to you? Even sinners lend to sinners, expecting to be repaid in full. But love your enemies, do good to them, and lend to them without expecting to get anything back. Then your reward will be great, and you will be children of the Most High, because He is kind to the ungrateful and wicked. Be merciful just as your Father is merciful. Do not judge, and you will not be judged. Do not condemn, and you will not be condemned. Forgive, and you will be forgiven. Give, and it will be given to you. A good measure, pressed down, shaken together, and running over, will be poured into your lap. For with the measure you use, it will be measured to you." This is the word of the Lord this morning, and we are grateful for it. Okay, let's start with a story. It's a bit of a sad one. Way back in 1992, a college student was murdered in plain sight on a busy street in front of the Daily Planet restaurant in Fresno, California. The story goes that two men riding a motorcycle pulled up beside the car she was about to get into. They pinned her to the side of the car with their motorcycle. They stole her purse, and when she resisted, one of them shot her in the head. Her name was Kimber Reynolds. Apparently, the man who shot her was a well-known meth addict who had his first run-in with the law when he was just 13 years old. His name was Joe Davis. At 13, he was trafficking heroin. Subsequent run-ins with the law would land him in prison, and he had been released from prison to visit his pregnant wife, but then he never returned. He was high when he shot and killed Miss Reynolds. In California at the time, there was a strong belief that the penalties associated with breaking the law were way too low. It's a sentiment that some in Seattle these days might resonate with. But in California, this sentiment had been germinating and gaining steam for some time, time enough that it made sense that just a day after her death, Kimber's dad could gather together in his backyard several police, prosecutors, neighbors, and friends to draft what became known as the Three Strikes Law. These same folks gathered thousands of signatures so that the document that they wrote in a grieving parent's backyard could become a state referendum. That referendum passed with unusually high support, and the actual law on the books is almost word for word what they wrote in just one day. The law stated that anyone convicted of a third offense, pretty much no matter what it is, even if it's totally petty, like stealing a slice of pizza or something, no matter what it is, the person must serve a mandatory sentence of 25 years to life. No exceptions. Under that law, Joe Davis never would have been let out of prison. Kimber wouldn't have been shot that night in front of the Daily Planet. After the law went into effect, there appeared to be a correlation between the passage of the law and a significant drop in crime rates. This whole story is told really compellingly in Malcolm Gladwell's David and Goliath, a book that I really recommend. So, in baseball, it's three strikes and you're out for an inning. In California, up until just a couple of years ago, it was three strikes and you are out for life. Kimber's dad, Mike, is something of a celebrity. The walls in his house are covered with awards and photos of him standing with dignitaries. Gladwell begins a chapter in his book setting Mike up as the David in the story. He's the little guy who stood up to the big bad guy and took him out, or rather put him and so many others in prison. But of course, there is a twist. Just wait for it. It is so easy to take Gladwell's bait because we love the Mikes of the world, right? I mean, in our culture, we respect and celebrate the weakling who stands up to the bully. We love the underling who takes revenge and gets justice. This actually may be the plot line of every movie I have ever seen. And there's more. Mike's way of thinking resonates with us. We want the bad guy to get the justice he's due and to not even have a chance to reoffend. We want to protect ourselves and our loved ones from the heroin trafficking criminals of the world. Of course we do, no exceptions. In Seattle, where a lot of crime goes overlooked and unpunished these days, the truth is, this sort of thinking really, really resonates with me, personally. This past December, in the alley behind the chapel, more than three fires were set under an abandoned structure. Three times we called 911 and the fire trucks rolled in and the police followed. And even though the chapel structure was threatened and the businesses nearby were threatened, the folks setting the fires were left to do their business. One night, there were 10-foot high flames. I stood in the alley the next morning with friends from the neighborhood. The smell of smoke was thick in the air, and every one of us wanted the same thing. Justice. And probably a little bit more. Some punishment for the people endangering the life and livelihoods in our neighborhood. And this makes sense. But then we get to our text this morning, and nothing makes sense. Everything gets turned upside down. Where some form of three strikes and you're out is the law of the land in 28 states, in God's kingdom, it is totally the opposite. Jesus says, in the face of an enemy, turn the other cheek. Bless those who curse you. Pray for those who mistreat you. Do good to those who hate you. Do not judge. Do not condemn. Forgive and you will be forgiven. Love your enemy. Holy 10-foot high flaming smokes. Right? Love your enemies. Do good to those who hate you. Turn the other cheek. Yikes. Does your soul pucker a bit at these words? At the thought of Kimber's dad forgiving Joe Davis? Loving him instead of locking him up? Jesus, his words here are radical. And they demand of us and of the church in general a lifestyle and a set of practices that seem nearly impossible, entirely countercultural. And if I'm completely honest, it's hard to not read this whole list of imperatives and feel as though Jesus sets us up to be the suckers of the world. It's hard to not look at this passage and feel as though Jesus intends for us to leave ourselves wide open to abuse. Because it's not just love your enemy. It's let people slap both sides of your face and burn down your building. It's if someone steals your coat, give them the shirt off your back. Jesus says, give to everyone who asks you, and if anyone takes what belongs to you, do not demand it back. Why love your enemies? Why this boundless generosity in the face of an adversary? What's going on here? And are we really supposed to follow these commands? The short answer to that last question is, of course, yes. Yes, as hard as it may be, we are supposed to follow Jesus' commands here. I think it helps to back up a bit and see the wider picture. These words of Jesus this morning, they come to us from a larger sermon. One that he spoke to his disciples at a really crucial point in his ministry. These words are part of that famous Sermon on the Plain, or Sermon on the Mount. So Jesus has just chosen 12 very ordinary human beings to be his disciples. And they represent a fresh start. So where originally the 12 tribes of Israel were chosen but failed miserably to witness to the world about their God of boundless love, now and instead, these 12 disciples and their followers would take up that task. And to prepare these ordinary folks for that extraordinary task, Jesus tells them exactly what they are supposed to do. He tells them what the kingdom of God really looks like, and he implores that they live according to the rules of the kingdom already in the here and now, so that all might see and know the one true God. Of course, God's kingdom is totally upside down from what we know and from what the world expects. And that's a bit of the point. Because who is going to notice us and wonder about our gracious God if we're doing the same thing as everyone else? If we're playing by the same rules as everyone else? Who is going to notice if we show love to those who love us? Everyone does that. Who is going to notice and wonder about our God if we give to someone and expect to be repaid? Everyone does that. Jesus wants his disciples to live in such a way that they might stand out. The Winter Olympics just wrapped up, right? I am one of the very average Americans that would say that I like the Winter Olympics because figure skating. And when I think about the why that we average Americans like figure skating, I think it's because it's this unique combination of athleticism and flouncy, dazzling fashion on ice. I mean, what is not to love, right? I think it's absolutely the case, though, that figure skating wouldn't be as loved if skaters wore sweatpants. It's a bedazzling sport because these people are literally bedazzled. And And I think if we want an illustration for what Jesus is doing here with his big sermon and these crazy tall orders, it's this. It's in a sense, Jesus is saying to his disciples, live life in such a way that you put sequins on it. And not just a few sequins, but all the sequins. Don't dress down like everyone else. Sparkle. You know what gets noticed in a world where the rules of reciprocity apply, and where greed is so normalized, and where punishment is expected? Ordinary people forgiving their enemies. Ordinary people treating others with unmerited favor. Ordinary people resisting the intrigues and trappings of human power. Ordinary people absorbing injustice for the sake of goodness. Ordinary people showing grace-filled favor to the most unfavorable. That stuff stands out. It sparkles. It shines light into a world that desperately needs light. Jesus says to his disciples, live in the kingdom now. Be like the one true God now, the God who is generous to all people, the God who gives good things to the undeserving, the God who is astonishingly merciful. N.T. Wright writes about this passage and the Sermon on the Plain in general, and he says that what we're supposed to take from this sermon is a way of doing life that shows that our God is different. So there was at work in the world in Jesus' day, and certainly in our own, this idea that all religions are really the same, and that all gods are really just a variant on the same theme. But our God is different. And Wright says, if you lived in a society where everyone believed in this God, our God, there wouldn't be any violence. There wouldn't be any revenge. There wouldn't be any divisions of class or caste. Property and possessions wouldn't be nearly as important as making sure your neighbor was all right. Imagine if even a few people around you took Jesus seriously and lived like that. Life would be exuberant, different, astonishing. People would stare. I have to go back to this David and Goliath book. In the same chapter that Gladwell follows Kim and Mike's story in The Three Strikes and You're Outlaw, he tells another story. And it's the story of a Mennonite family whose oldest daughter was murdered in a similarly tragic way. She was 14, found tied up in a shed not far from the family's home. Just terrible. But instead of gathering a group of folks in their backyard and attempting to get stricter punishment for their daughter's murderer, they do this very radical thing. They grieve their daughter's death, and then they forgive her murderer. Gladwell quotes the mom in the story, and I cried when I read it, and I might cry again. She says, I was taught that there was an alternative way to deal with injustice. I was taught it in school. We were taught the history of persecution. We had this picture of martyrdom that went back to the 16th century. The whole Mennonite philosophy is that we forgive and we move on. Gladwell writes, to the Mennonites, forgiveness is a religious imperative. Forgive those who trespass against you. But it's also a very practical strategy based on the belief that there are profound limits to what the formal mechanisms of retribution can accomplish. And this is true. Retribution has limits. God might know something about this. And you should know that studies have actually shown that the three strikes laws are kind of terrible. California and many other states have scaled these laws way back because it turns out if you lock up too many people for too long, the collateral damage done to families and whole communities is hugely damaging, such that it outweighs the immediate benefits. Do hear me correctly. I am not saying that people shouldn't ever serve jail time for terrible crimes. I am not saying that. Obviously, we need a system in place that helps keep people safe. I am pointing to this rather wily trait in us that desires for folks to suffer for their wrongdoing. And I think that that's what Jesus is getting at too. Case in point, in Gladwell's book, we're told that Mike, the murdered girl's father who sought retribution, he was actually the Goliath in the story. And this little Mennonite family, they were the David in the story. Because forgiveness, surprising as it may seem, is the vastly more powerful way when put next to retribution. When put next to this very human eye for an eye sense of justice. Gladwell tells us that Mike is a terribly sad and hollowed out man, never having been able to move on from his daughter's death. He revisits the restaurant where she was killed so often so that his presence haunts it, and the restaurant owner and the managers tell him to leave all the time. Gladwell ends the chapter with this: a man employs the full power of the state in his grief and ends up plunging his government into a fruitless and costly experiment. A woman walks away from the power, or from the promise of power, and finds the strength to forgive. And along the way, saves her friendship, her marriage, and her sanity. The world is turned upside down, he says. We Christians say God's kingdom is upside down. And it is. Loving your enemy, forgiveness, cup overflowing generosity, these are upside down ideas. And I think that's because our God is different. Our God emptied himself out before his enemies. Our God hung from a cross. When they struck him on his cheek, took his coat and the shirt off his back, our God kept on loving and forgiving right up to the very end. And then, friends, what might happen if a few more of us took our God seriously? What would happen if we lived like God told us to live? Ordinary people living extraordinary, generous, love-filled lives. Ordinary people emptying ourselves out for our neighbors. Ordinary people finding strength in mercy. Ordinary people forgiving and moving on. Perhaps our own lives would be vastly more exuberant. Certainly we would be different. People would stare. But they also might wonder why. They also might begin to see and know that our God is real. And I think at the end of the day, that's the whole point. I'm coming to the end, I promise. But first, I have to go back to the alleyway by the chapel. The folks who were starting the fires showed up to Friday feast on Christmas Eve. I spoke to the woman whose partner kept accidentally starting the fires in an attempt to keep warm. Most of the woman's hair had fallen out. Her face was just covered in pockmarks from drugs, She had bruises on her neck. Looking into her eyes was a startling reminder to me that she, this very broken, desperate human, and her similarly broken partner, they are not my enemy. Just aren't. My enemy, our enemies, are the deeper, more systemic things like poverty, racism, and hate. Right? These vile things that at the end of the day, only God can conquer and only God can put right. And I do think that we Christians would do well to remember who the real enemy is. And it isn't our neighbors, folks. It just isn't our neighbors. No matter the crazy shenanigans they pull, no matter who they are, the real enemy is not our neighbors. We should want our neighbors, all of our neighbors, to see and know that our God is real and that our God is different. And we know that this happens only when we live differently. When you love instead of hate, when you turn the other cheek, when you give more radically than all the rest. This happens when we live as Christ lived. With all that said, I'm going to end here just by reading Christ's words one more time. May they sink into your hearts and your minds and your souls, and may you be inspired to change, to live them. Jesus says to us, to you who are listening, I say, love your enemies. Do good to those who hate you. Bless those who curse you. Pray for those who mistreat you. If someone slaps you on one cheek, turn to them the other also. If someone takes your coat, do not withhold your shirt from them. Give to everyone who asks you, and if anyone takes what belongs to you, do not demand it back. Do to others as you would have them do to you. If you love those who love you, what credit is that to you? Even sinners love those who love them. And if you do good to those who are good to you, what credit is that to you? Even sinners do that. And if you lend to those from whom you expect repayment, what credit is that to you? Even sinners lend to sinners expecting to be repaid in full. But love your enemies. Do good to them. Lend to them without expecting to get anything back. Then your reward will be great, and you will be children of the Most High, because he is kind to the ungrateful and the wicked. Be merciful just as your Father is merciful. Do not judge, and you will not be judged. Do not condemn, and you will not be condemned. Forgive, and you will be forgiven. Give, and it will be given to you. A good measure, pressed down, shaken together and running over, will be poured into your lap. For with the measure you use, it will be measured to you. Friends, let's go to our God in prayer.